In recent years, there's been a movement in the food world to buy local, support family farms, and eat more naturally. Our next guest says that's okay as far as it goes, but that we're ignoring a huge part of the story of local food, the reliance on migrant workers, and their well-being.
She says these workers are subject to long hours, low wages, and hazardous working conditions, and if we want the local food movement to succeed in an ethical way, we need to start protecting the workers at the heart of these farming operations.
We're joined now by Margaret Gray. She's an associate professor of political science at Adelphi University. She's the author of Labor and the Locavore, The Making of a Comprehensive Food Ethic. Margaret, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, you point out in your book that locavorism, whatever people want to call it, is held up as kind of a virtuous model of sustainable eating. But you say we're missing the story of the workers. Why hasn't that been paid attention to?
You know what? That's a great question. I think the main answer to why we've paid attention to the environment, why we've paid attention to the way animals are treated and to the plight of small farmers is that when it comes to the labor conditions, this is seen as actually challenging the farmers themselves. But I think the other side of it is that for the most part, what you read about the local food movement and what you read about the production processes, it's very romanticized. And I think we're often given the impression that these are teeny tiny farms. They maybe don't even have any workers. But I think given that we're told that almost everything else is better on smaller local farms, that we're also, it's easy to jump to the conclusion that working conditions are better as well. So I think there's two parts, our own romance with farms and the way that food writing has primed us to think that way.
So as you point out, just because a farm is small, just because it's a family farm, doesn't mean they don't have farm laborers. What you focused on the Hudson River Valley, but I think this is similar to places around the country. What were working conditions like for these farm workers?
Sure. So the first thing that I think listeners should keep in mind is that farm workers in most of the country do not have a right to overtime pay. They don't have a right to a day of rest, and they don't have collective bargaining protections. So, you know, I've met workers who are working 70, 80, 90-hour work weeks, and not just for 2 weeks of peak harvest, but repeatedly long hours and just getting paid straight minimum wage. So part of it is the law itself creates an opportunity for these workers to be exploited. I think the other thing to keep in mind is that the vast majority of farm workers are non-citizen workers, and they're afraid to complain. So they often don't want to say, hey, we're working too fast, or it's really too hot out, or are you sure that my paycheck is paid correctly? So part of it is also their own fear, and their fear to a certain extent is that they're going to lose their jobs, that they're going to be deported. But they've also heard other stories about workers getting fired for asking questions like this. So that's another part of it. And, you know, you can ask any farmer. Farm work itself is difficult work. It's all manual labor. And especially on, you know, Hudson Valley diversified farms, you don't have mechanization. So we're talking about all hand labor here.
And you talk to a lot of the farm workers, some of them undocumented immigrants, some guest workers. What did they tell you about why they did these jobs despite low pay, despite these tough working conditions?
Yeah, it's a pretty old immigrant story that they just don't have the same opportunity in their home countries. And so that's why they're here. They want to provide for their families. They want to put in a real floor in their home. They want to have indoor plumbing. They want to pay for medical bills. They want to send their kids to school. So in that sense, it's a sort of old story. They're also just acutely aware. So many of them have just a grade school education, and they don't have English language skills. And so there are very few jobs they feel are open to them, and farm work is one of the jobs that is open to them.
And you point out that often these farm workers might be provided with lodging while they work on a farm, or maybe food or other perks like that, but that comes, you say, with a downside. What is that?
Yeah, so I call this the price of proximity. So on the one hand, the proximity we have as consumers to local food is something we really enjoy. We get fresh food, they taste better, and we get to buy it not in a corporate grocery store. The flip side of that is that there's a price of proximity for these workers who are living on the farms. So as soon as your boss is in charge of some aspect of your life outside of work, that's a recipe for a paternalistic relationship to develop. And what happens with paternalism is that workers get housing, they might be able to take food from the farm, they might be able to use farm vehicles, maybe the farmer does them little favors to help them out. And I have talked to plenty of farmers, and I think that they often are doing this to be generous, that they want to help the workers. But the flip side is that the workers feel that they better behave really well in order to maintain those benefits. And so there are different layers of those benefits. And the more extensive the benefits, the more that they act as a form of labor control, because workers are interested in continuing to secure those benefits.
So you're not, well, not only is your job at risk, but maybe your home is at risk then.
Yes, exactly.
Well, we just have a couple minutes, and I want to get to the consumer side. You point out the irony that there's a growing trend, some people maybe in the local food movement, asking how an animal was raised before they eat it, but not asking how the workers who raised that animal or the other foodstuffs are treated.
Yeah, so, I'm talking about a food ethic, and I take that directly from food writers like Michael Pollan. And I think when consumers want to know that the animals were treated well, it's about a food ethic. And so the same way that we've primed consumers to say, hey, ask questions about how much space these animals have, ask questions about the pesticide use. Nobody up until now has been priming us to ask questions about workers. So I think, I think this is the natural next step for the food movement to really embrace working conditions, improving them.
And does this all boil down to, even if we want local food, we want it to be cheap, there's this pressure on the farmer, and what do we do about that?
So, yes, I think this is definitely part of a much greater conversation about how cheap our food is in this country. But there's an agricultural economist, Philip Martin, at UC Davis, and what he showed is that if you increased farm worker wages by 40%, it would only cost the American consumer about $16 a year. And you also have the Coalition of Immokalee Workers in Florida, and they had a penny per pound of tomato increase, and that penny per pound increase has led to a substantial improvement in farm worker wages for those tomato workers. So, yes, I think consumers are going to have to pay more, but it's probably not the same dramatic increase that we expect if that money gets passed directly to the workers.
Margaret, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Take care.
We've been talking to Margaret Gray. She's an associate professor of political science at Adelphi University. Her new book is called Labor and the Locavore, The Making of a Comprehensive Food Ethic.